Oh, nice one, son. The whole place is meant to intimidate you to the max. The scrub's wall is daunting to look at, 20 feet. But someone tapped you on the shoulder and said, Blake got over it. 9 months earlier, the spy George Blake's friends had dropped a ladder over the wall and spirited him away to Moscow. A sensational escape. But having Russian friends to spirit you away is another thing. I walked around in an orderly circle with so much rabbit going on, it took me a while to get a touch on the back. Keith, you got bail, you sod. I said, any messages? Give them to me now. I had to deliver about 10 notes to families. Tearful. There were some mean mothers there. Most of them were warders. The head bugger said to me as I got in the Bentley, you'll be back. I said to him, not on your time, I won't. Our lawyers had filed an appeal, and I'd been released on bail. Before the appeal hearing, the Times, great champion of the underdog, came unexpectedly to our assistance. There must remain a suspicion, wrote William Rees-Mogg, the Times editor, in his piece, Who Breaks a Butterfly on a Wheel, that Mr. Jagger received a harsher sentence than would ever have been handed down to an unknown defendant, i.e., you've cocked it up and made British justice look bad. In actual fact, we got saved by Rees-Mogg, because believe me, I felt like a butterfly at the time, and I'm going to be broke. When you look back at the brutality of the establishment and the Profumo affair, something as dirty as any John le Carré story, in which inconvenient players were framed and hounded to their death, I'm quite amazed it didn't get more bloody than it did. In that same month, my conviction was overturned and Mix was upheld, but his sentence squashed. Not so lucky, Robert Fraser, who had pleaded guilty to heroin possession. He had to do his porridge. I think that the experience and the King's African Rifles had more effect on him than Wormwood Scrubs. He'd thrown loads of guys in a janker's army for the glasshouse, which is slopping out the bugs or digging new latrines. It wasn't as if he had no idea about confinement and punishment. I'm sure Africa was a bit rougher than anywhere else. He went in very bold. Never flinched. I thought he came out very bold too. Bow tie, cigarette holder. I said, let's get stoned. The same day we were released, the strangest TV discussion ever filmed took place between Mick, flown in by helicopter to some English lawn, and representatives of the ruling establishment. They were like figures from Alice, chessmen. A bishop, a Jesuit, an attorney general, and Rees-Mogg. They'd been sent out as a scouting party, waving a white flag to discover whether the new youth culture was a threat to the established order, trying to bridge the unbridgeable gap between generations. They were earnest and awkward, and it was ludicrous. Their questions amounted to, what do you want? We're laughing up our sleeves. They were trying to make peace with us, like Chamberlain. Little bit of paper. Peace in our time. Peace in our time. All they're trying to do is retain their positions. But such beautiful English earnestness, this concern, it was astounding. Yet you know they're carrying weight. They can bring down some heavy-duty shit. So there were this underlying aggressiveness in the guise of all this amused curiosity. In a way, they were begging Mick for answers. I thought Mick came off pretty well. He didn't attempt to answer them. He just said, you're living in the past. Much of that year, we struggled haphazardly to make their satanic majesty's request. None of us wanted to make it. But it was time for another Stones album. And Sgt. Pepper's was coming out, so we thought, basically, we were doing a put-on. We do have the first 3D record cover of all time. That was acid, too. We made that set ourselves. We went to New York, put ourselves in the hands of this Japanese bloke with the only camera in the world that could do the 3D. Bits of paint and saws, bits of styrofoam. We need some plants. Okay, we'll go down the Flower District. It coincided with the departure of Andrew Oldham, dropping the pilot, who was now in a bad way, getting shock treatment for some insurmountable mental pain to do with women trouble. He was also spending a lot of time with his own label, Immediate Records. Things might have run their course, but there was something between Mick and him that couldn't be resolved, that I can only speculate on. They were falling out of sync with each other. Mick was starting to feel his oats and wanted to test it out by getting rid of Oldham. And to be fair to Mick, Andrew was getting big ideas. And why not? A year or two before, he was nobody. Now he wanted to be Phil Spector. But all he's got is his five-piece rock and roll band to do it with. He would spend an inordinate amount of time, once a couple of hits had rolled in, trying to make these Spector-type records. Andrew wasn't concentrating on the Stones anymore. Added to that, we could no longer create coverage in the way Oldham had done. We were no longer writing the headlines, we were ducking them. And that meant another of Oldham's jobs had gone. His box of tricks was exhausted. Anita and I went back to Morocco for Christmas in 1967 with Robert Fraser soon after he got out of jail. Chrissy Gibbs took a house belonging to an Italian hairdresser in Marrakesh. It was a house with a big garden that had run wild. The garden was full of peacocks and white flowers coming up through weeds and grass. Marrakesh gets very dry, and when the rains come, all this vegetation comes piercing through. It was cold and wet, so there was a lot of making fires in the house. And we were also smoking a lot of dope. Gibbs had a big pot of marjan, the Moroccan candy made of grass and spices that he brought from Tangier. And Robert was very keen about this person who Brian Gyson had put us all onto, who was also a maker of marjan, Mr. Very Good, who worked in the Mishmash, the jam factory, and made us apricot jam in the evening. We had dropped in on Ahmed in Tangier on the way. His shop was now decorated with collages of the Stones. He'd cut up old seed catalogues, and our faces peered out from a forest of sweet peas and hyacinths. This was the period when dope could be mailed in various ways, and the best hash, if you could get any, was Afghani Primo, which used to come in two shapes, like flying saucers with a seal on it, or in the shape of a sandal or the sole of a sandal. And it used to have white veins in it that were apparently goat shit, part of the cement. And over the next couple of years, Ahmed would send out large quantities of hashish sealed in the bases of brass candlesticks. Soon he had four shops in a row, and big American cars with Norwegian au pair girls falling out of back. All kinds of wonderful things happened to him. And then, a couple of years later, I heard he was in a slammer with everything taken from him. Gibbs looked after him and kept in touch with him until he died. Tangier was a place of fugitives and suspects, marginal characters acting other lives. On the beach in Tangier on that trip, we saw these two strange beach boys walking along, dressed in suits, looking like the Blues Brothers. It was the Cray twins. Ronnie liked little Moroccan boys, and Reggie used to indulge him. They brought a touch of South End with them. Handkerchief knotted on the corners over the head and trousers rolled up. And those were the days when you were reading about how they'd murdered the axemen and all those people nailed to the floor. The rough mixed with the smooth. Paul Getty and his beautiful and doomed wife, Talitha, had just bought their huge palace at Sidi Maman, where we stayed one night. There was a character called Arndt Krupp von Bullen und Holbach, whose name I remember because he was the gaily painted heir to the Krupp millions, and a degenerate even by my standards. I believe he may have been in the car during one of the most terrifying moments I've had in a motor car, in one of my closest shades with mortality. Certainly Michael Cooper was in the car, and maybe Robert Fraser, and one other. It might have been Krupp. And had it been the heir to the munitions empire, it would have been ironic what nearly befell us. Well, we'd gone on a trip to Vez and rented Peugeot and left at night to go back to Marrakesh, across the Atlas Mountains. I was driving. Up there, among the hairpin bends, halfway down, round the corner right in front of me, without any buyer leave, coming at us, there were these two motorcycles. Military, I realised, by the uniforms, and they were covering all of the road. So he managed to swerve there, I managed to get round here, but down below is half a mile of forget about it. So I pull back in, swerve around, and in front of me now is this huge truck with more motorcycle outriders. And I ain't going over, so I clipped one of the motorcyclists and I went right by the thing. They went bananas. And as we're passing by it, there's a huge missile, a rocket, on the truck. We're going round the bend, and we've just made it. I've got one wheel over the abyss. I just managed to save us. What the fuck is this doing in the middle of the road? And seconds later, boom! It went over. We hear this huge crash and explosion. It was so fast, I don't think they knew what happened. This was a long, big motherfucker, an articulated truck. But how we got away with it, I don't really know. Just drove on, foot down, deal with the hairpins. My night driving abilities were famous at that time. We changed cars when we got down in Meknes. I went to the garage and said, this car isn't working very well. Can we rent another one? We just got the hell out of there. I was expecting NATO on my tail or something. At least an immediate military response, helicopters and searchlights. The next day we're looking in the papers. Not a mention. Falling down a cliff into an abyss astride a third world rocket would have been a sad end. Perhaps the only fitting send-off for the heir to the Krupp armaments fortune. I was suffering from hepatitis on that trip and virtually crawled out of there. But my luck still holding into the welcoming arms of one of medicine's great Dr. Feelgoods, Dr. Ben Sasson in Paris. Anita took me to Catherine Harley. She was a model agent, a Sufi, an incredible woman who had a great range of contacts. She was like Anita's spiritual mother and took her in when she was ill or in trouble. It was she who Brian Jones went to when Anita left to try and get her back. It was Catherine who put me in touch with Dr. Ben Sasson. Already the name, Algerian probably, gave me the hope of something other than conventional medicine. Dr. Ben Sasson used to go to Orly Airport and meet sheiks and kings and princes who were just stopping off on their way to somewhere else. And he would go and fix them up, whatever the time of day or night. In my case, it was heavy-duty hepatitis, and it was really sucking me out. I had no strength. I went to visit Dr. Ben Sasson, who gave me this shot. It took 20 minutes to go in. and it was basically a concoction of vitamins, everything that's good for you, and then something else very nice. I'd crawl into his store and just manage to get my ass in there, and half an hour later I'd walk back. Forget the car. An amazing shot. Amazing cocktail concoction. Whatever it was, I've got to take my hat off. I mean, in 6 weeks he had me rocking. And not only did he deal with the hepatitis, he built me up and made me feel good at the same time. But I also have an incredible immune system. I cured myself of hepatitis C without even bothering to do anything about it. I'm a rare case. I read my body very well. The only trouble was that with these preoccupations and interruptions, the legal problems, the flights abroad, the wobbling of our relationship with Oldham, we had been temporarily distracted from what was now alarming and evident. The Rolling Stones had run out of gas. Chapter 7. In which, in the late 1960s, I discover open tuning and heroin. Meet Gram Parsons, sail to South America, become a father, record Wild Horses and Brown Sugar in Mussel Shoals, survive Altamont, and re-meet a saxophonist named Bobby Keys. We'd run out of gas. I don't think I realised it at the time, but that was a period where we could have foundered, a natural end to a hit-making band. It came soon after Satanic Majesties, which is all a bit of flim-flam to me. And this is where Jimmy Miller comes into the picture as our new producer. What a great collaboration. Out of the drift, we extracted Beggar's Banquet and helped take the Stones to a different level. This is where we had to pull out the good stuff, and we did. I remember our first meeting with Jimmy. Mick was instrumental in getting him involved. Jimmy came from Brooklyn originally, grew up in the West. His father was entertainment director of the Vegas gambling hotels, the Sahara, the Dunes, the Flamingo. We turned up in Olympic Studios and said, we'll have a run through and see how things go. We just played. Anything. We weren't trying to make a track that day. We were feeling the room, feeling Jimmy out, and Jimmy was feeling us out. I'd like to go back and be a fly on that wall. All I remember is having a very, very good feeling about him when we left the session about 12 hours later. I was playing the stuff, going into the control room, usual old trick, and actually hearing on the playback what was going on in the room. Sometimes what you're playing in the room is totally different from what you hear in the control room. But Jimmy was hearing the room, hearing the band. So I had a very strong thing with him from that first day. He had a natural feel for the band because of what he'd been doing, working with English guys. He'd produced things like I'm a Man and Give Me Some Lovin' by the Spencer Davis Group. He'd worked with Traffic, Blind Faith. He worked a lot with black guys. But most of all, it was because Jimmy Miller was a damn good drummer. He understood groove. He's the drummer on Happy. He was the original drummer on You Can't Always Get What You Want. He made it very easy for me to work. Mainly for me to set the groove, set the tempos. And at the same time, Mick and Jimmy were communicating well. It gave Mick confidence to go along with him too. Our thing was playing Chicago blues. That's where we took everything that we knew. That was our kickoff point, Chicago. Look at that Mississippi River. Where does it come from? Where does it go? Follow that river all the way up, and you'll end up in Chicago. Also, follow the way those artists were recorded. There were no rules. If you looked at the regular way of recording things, everything was recorded totally wrong. But what is wrong and what is right? What matters is what hits the ear. Chicago blues was so raw and raucous and energetic. If you try to record it clean, forget about it. Nearly every Chicago blues record you hear is an enormous amount over the top, loading the sound on in layers of thickness. When you hear Little Walter's records, he hits the first note on his harp and the band disappears until that note stops because he's overloading it. When you're making records, you're looking to distort things, basically. I mean, that's the freedom recording gives you, to fuck around with a sound. And it's not a matter of sheer force. It's always a matter of experiment and playing around. Hey, this is a nice mic, but if we put it a little closer to the amp, and then take a smaller amp instead of the big one and shove that mic right in front of it, cover the mic with a towel, let's see what we get. What you're looking for is where the sounds just melt into one another and you've got that beat behind it. And the rest of it just has to squirm and roll its way through. If you have it all separated, it's insipid. What you're looking for is power and force without volume, an inner power, a way to bring together what everybody in that room is doing and make one sound. So it's not two guitars, piano, bass and drums. It's one thing. It's not five. You are there to create one thing. Jimmy produced Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, every Stones record through Goat's Head Soup in 1973, the backbone stuff. But the best thing we ever did with Jimmy Miller was Jumping Jack Flash. That song and Street Fighting Man came out of the very first sessions with Jimmy at Olympic Studios for what would become Beggar's Banquet in the spring of 1968, the May of street fighting in Paris. Suddenly, between us, this whole new idea started to blossom, this new second wind, and it just became more and more fun. Mick was coming up with some great ideas and great songs. Like Dear Doctor, I think probably Marianne had something to do with that, and Sympathy for the Devil. Although, it was not in the way he envisioned it when it started. I mean, but that's in the Godard movie. I'll deal with Godard later, where you hear and see the transformation of the song. Parachute Woman, with that weird sound area, like a fly buzzing in your ear or a mosquito or something, that song came so easily. I thought it was going to be difficult because I had that concept of that sound and wasn't sure it would work. But Mick jumped on the idea just like that, and it took a little time to record. Salt of the Earth. I think I came up with the title of that and had the basic spur of it, but Mick did all the verses. This was our thing. I'd sparked the idea. Let's drink to the hard-working people. Let's drink to the salt of the earth. And after that, Mick, it's all yours. Halfway through, he'd say, where do we break it? Where do we go to the middle? Where's the bridge? See how long he would take this one idea before he turned to me and said, we got to go somewhere else now. Ah, the bridge. Some of that is technical work, a matter of discussion, and usually very quick and easy. It was a lot of country and blues on Beggar's Banquet. No Expectations, Dear Doctor, even Jigsaw Puzzle. Parachute Woman, Prodigal Son, Stray Cat Blues, Factory Girl. They're all either blues or folk music. By then, we were thinking, hey, give us a good song. We can do it. We've got the sound, and we know we can find it one way or another if we've got the song. And we'll chase the damn thing all around the room up to the ceiling. We know we've got it, and we'll lock onto it and find it. I don't know what it was in this period that worked so well. Maybe timing. We had barely explored the stuff where we come from or that it turned us on. The Dear Doctors and Country Hunks in Love in Vain. Well, they were in a way catch-up, things we had to do. The mixture of black and white American music had plenty of space in it to be explored. We also knew that the Stones fans were digging it, and there were an awful lot of them by then. Without thinking about it, we knew that they'd love it. All we've got to do is what we want to do, and they're going to love it. That's what we're about. Because if we love it, a certain thing comes across from it. They were damn good songs. We never forget a good hook. We've never let one go when we found it. I think I can talk for the Stones most of the time. And we didn't care what they wanted out there. That was one of the charms of the Stones. And the rock and roll stuff that we did come out with on Beggar's Banquet was enough. You can't say, apart from Sympathy or Street Fightin' Man, that there's rock and roll on Beggar's Banquet at all. Stray Cat is a bit of funk, but the rest of them are folk songs. We were incapable of writing to order to say we need a rock and roll track. Mick tried it later with some drivel. It was not the interesting thing about the Stones, just sheer rock and roll. I love rock and roll on stage, but it was not something we particularly recorded a lot of, unless we knew we had a diamond, like Brown Sugar or Start Me Up. And also, it kind of made the up-tempo numbers stand out even more against the lovely bedrock of really great little songs, like No Expectations. I mean, the body of work was not a smashy between the eyes. This was not heavy metal. This was music. Flash. Shit, what a record. All my stuff came together and all done on a cassette player. With Jumpin' Jack Flash and Street Fightin' Man, I discovered a new sound I could get out of an acoustic guitar. That grinding, dirty sound came out of these crummy little motels where the only thing you had to record with was this new invention called the cassette recorder. And it didn't disturb anybody. Suddenly, you had a very mini studio. Playing an acoustic, you'd overload the Philips cassette player to the point of distortion so that when it played back, it was effectively an electric guitar. You're using the cassette player as a pickup and an amplifier at the same time. You were forcing acoustic guitars through a cassette player, and what came out the other end was electric as hell. An electric guitar will jump live in your hands. It's like holding on to an electric eel. An acoustic guitar is very dry, and you have to play it a different way. But if you can get that different sound electrified, you get this amazing tone and this amazing sound. I've always loved the acoustic guitar, loved playing it. And I thought, if I can just power this up a bit without going to electric, I'll have a unique sound. It's got a little tingle on the top. It's unexplainable, but it's something that fascinated me at the time. In the studio, I plugged the cassette into a little extension speaker and put a microphone in front of the extension speaker so it had a bit more breath and depth, and put that on tape. That was the basic track. There are no electric instruments on Street Fighting Man at all, apart from the bass, which I overdubbed later. All acoustic guitars. Jumping Jack Flash, the same. I wish I could still do that, but they don't build machines like that anymore. They put a limiter on it soon after that, so you couldn't overload it. Just as you're getting off on something, they put a lock on it. The band all thought I was mad, and they sort of indulged me. But I heard a sound that I could get out of there, and Jimmy was onto it immediately. Street Fighting Man, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Half a Gimme Shelter were all made just like that, on a cassette machine. I used to layer guitar on guitar. Sometimes there are 8 guitars on those tracks. You just mash them up. Charlie Watts's drums on Street Fighting Man are from this little 1930s practice drummer's kit in a little suitcase that you popped up. One tiny cymbal, a half-sized tambourine that served as a snare. And that's really what it was made on. Made on rubbish. Made in hotel rooms. With our little toys. That was a magic discovery, but so were these riffs. These crucial, wonderful riffs that just came, I don't know where from. I'm blessed with them, and I can never get to the bottom of them. When you get a riff like Flash, you get a great feeling of elation, a wicked glee. Of course, then comes the other thing, of persuading people that it is as great as you actually know it is. You have to go through the poo-poo, yeah. Flash is basically satisfaction in reverse. Nearly all of these riffs are closely related. But if someone said you can play only one of your riffs ever again, I'd say, okay, give me Flash. I love satisfaction dearly and everything, but those chords are pretty much a de rigueur course as far as songwriting goes. But Flash is particularly interesting. It's all right now. It's almost Arabic, or very old, archaic, classical. The chord setups you could only hear in Gregorian chants or something like that. And it's that weird mixture of your actual rock and roll and at the same time this weird echo of very, very ancient music that you don't even know. It's much older than I am, and that's unbelievable. It's like a recall of something, and I don't know where it came from. But I know where the lyrics came from. They came from a grey dawn at Redlands. Mick and I had been up all night. It was raining outside and there was the sound of these heavy, stomping rubber boots near the window, belonging to my gardener, Jack Dyer, real country man from Sussex. It woke Mick up. He said, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, that's Jack. That's Jumpin' Jack." I started to work around the phrase on the guitar, which was an open tuning, singing the phrase, "Jumpin' Jack." Mick said, "Flash." And suddenly, we had this phrase with a great rhythm and ring to it. So we got to work on it and wrote it. I can hear the whole band take off behind me every time I play Flash. There's this extra sort of turbo overdrive. You jump on the riff, and it plays you. We have ignition? Okay, let's go. Daryl Jones will be right next to me on the bass. What are we on now? Flash? Okay, let's go. One, two, three. And then you don't look at each other again because you know you're in for the ride now. It'll always make you play it different depending on what tempo you're in. Levitation is probably the closest analogy to what I feel. Whether it's jumping jack or satisfaction or all down the line. When I realise that I've hit the right tempo and the band's behind me, it's like taking off in a Learjet. I have no sense that my feet are touching the ground. I'm elevated to this other space. People say, why don't you give it up? I can't retire until I croak. I don't think they quite understand what I get out of this. I'm not doing it just for the money or for you. I'm doing it for me. The big discovery, late 1968 or early 1969, was when I started playing the open five-string tuning. It transformed my life. It's the way of playing that I use for the riffs and songs the Stones are best known for. Honky Tonk Women, Brown Sugar, Tumbling Dice, Happy, all down the line. Start Me Up and Satisfaction, Flash too. I had hit a kind of buffer. I just really thought I was not getting anywhere from straight concert tuning. I wasn't learning anymore. I wasn't getting some of the sounds I really wanted. I'd been experimenting with tunings for quite a while. Most times I went into different tunings because I had a song going and I was hearing it in my head, but I couldn't get it out of the conventional tuning no matter any way I looked at it. Also, I wanted to try to go back and use what a lot of the old blues guitarists were playing and transpose it to electric, but keep the same basic simplicity and straightforwardness, that pumping drive that you hear with the acoustic blues players. Simple, haunting, powerful sounds. And then I found out all this stuff about banjos. A lot of five-string playing came from when Sears Roebuck offered the Gibson guitar in the very early 20s, really cheap. Before that, banjos were the biggest selling instrument. Gibson put out this cheap, really good guitar, and cats would tune it, since they were nearly all banjo players, to a five-string banjo tuning. Also, you didn't have to pay for the other string, the big string. Or you could save it for hanging the old lady or something. Most of rural America bought their stuff from the Sears catalogue. Rural America was where it was really important. In the cities, you could shop around. In the Bible Belt, rural America, the South, Texas, the Midwest, you got your Sears Roebuck catalogue and you're sent away. That's how Oswald got his shooter. Usually that banjo tuning was used on a guitar for slide playing or bottleneck. An open tuning simply means the guitar is pre-tuned to a ready-made major chord. But there are different kinds and configurations. I've been working on open D and open E. I learned then that Don Everly, one of the finest rhythm players, used open tuning on Wake Up Little Susie and Bye Bye Love. He just used the bar chord, the finger across the neck. Ry Cooda was the first cat I actually saw play the open G chord. I have to say I tip my hat to Ry Cooda. He showed me the open G tuning, but he was using it strictly for slide playing, and he still had the bottom string. That's what most blues players use open tunings for. They use it for slide. And I decided that was too limiting. I found the bottom string got in the way. I figured out after a bit that I didn't need it. It would never stay in tune. It was out of whack for what I wanted to do. So I took it off. and I used the fifth string, the A string, as the bottom note. You didn't have to worry about bashing that bottom string and setting up harmonics and stuff you didn't need. I started playing chords on the open tuning, which was new ground. You change one string, and suddenly you've got a whole new universe under your fingers. Anything you thought you knew, it's gone out the window. Nobody thought about playing minor chords in an open major tuning, because you've got to really dodge about a bit. You have to rethink your whole thing, as if your piano was turned upside down and the black notes were white and the white notes were black. So you had to retune your mind and your fingers, as well as a guitar. The minute you've tuned a guitar or any other instrument to one chord, you've got to work your way around it. You're out of the realms of normal music. You're out the Limpopo with Yellow Jack. The beauty, the majesty of the five-string open G tuning for an electric guitar is that you've only got three notes. The other two are repetitions of each other an octave apart. It's tuned G, D, G, B, D. Certain strings run through the whole song, so you get a drone going all the time. And because it's electric, they reverberate. Only three notes, but because of these different octaves, it fills the whole gap between bass and top notes with sound. It gives you this beautiful resonance and ring. I found working with open tunings, there's a million places you don't need to put your fingers. The notes are there already. You can leave certain strings wide open. It's finding the spaces in between makes open tuning work. And if you're working the right chord, you can hear this other chord going on behind it, which actually you're not playing. It's there. It defies logic. And it's just lying there saying, fuck me. And it's a matter of the same old cliche in that respect. It's what you leave out that counts. Yeah. Let it go, so that one note harmonizes off the other. And so even though you've now changed your fingers to another position, that note is still ringing. And you can even let it hang there. It's called the drone note, or at least that's what I call it. The sitar works on similar lines. Sympathetic ringing, or what they call the sympathetic strings. Logically, it shouldn't work. But when you play it, and that note keeps ringing, even though you've now changed to another chord, you realize that that is the root note of the whole thing you're trying to do. It's the drone. I just got fascinated by relearning the guitar. It really invigorated me. It was like a different instrument in a way. And literally, too. I had to have the five-string guitars made for me. I've never wanted to play like anybody else, except when I was first starting, when I wanted to be Scotty Moore or Chuck Berry. After that, I wanted to find out what the guitar or the piano could teach me. The five-string took me back to the tribesmen of West Africa. They had a very similar instrument, sort of a five-string, kind of like a banjo, but they would use the same drone, a thing to set up other voices and drums over the top. Always underneath it was this underlying one note that went through it. And you listen to some of that meticulous Mozart stuff and Vivaldi, and you realize that they knew that too. They knew when to leave one note just hanging up there, where it illegally belongs, and let it dangle in the wind and turn a dead body into a living beauty. Gus used to point it out to me. Just listen to that one note hanging there. All the other stuff that's going on underneath is crap, but that one note makes it sublime. It's something primordial in the way we react to pulses without even knowing it. We exist on a rhythm of 72 beats a minute. The train, apart from getting them from the Delta to Detroit, became very important to blues players because of the rhythm of the machine, the rhythm of the tracks. And then when you cross onto another track, the beat moves. It echoes something in the human body. So then when you have machinery involved, like trains and drones, all of that is still built in as music inside us. The human body will feel rhythms even when there's not one. Listen to Mystery Train by Elvis Presley. One of the great rock and roll tracks of all time, not a drum on it. It's just a suggestion, because the body will provide the rhythm. Rhythm really only has to be suggested. It doesn't have to be pronounced. This is where they got it wrong with this rock and that rock. It's got nothing to do with rock. It's to do with roll. Five strings cleared out the clutter. It gave me the licks and laid on textures. You could almost play the melody through the chords because of the notes you can throw in. And suddenly, instead of it being two guitars playing, it sounds like a goddamn orchestra. Or you can no longer tell who's playing what. And hopefully, if it's really good, no one will care. It's just fantastic. It was like scales falling from your eyes and from your ears at the same time. It broke open the dam. Ian Stewart used to refer to us affectionately as my little three-chord wonders. But it is an honourable title. Okay, this song has got three chords, right? What can you do with those three chords? Tell it to John Lee Hooker. Most of his songs are on one chord. Howling Wolf stuff, one chord. And Bo Diddley. It was listening to them that made me realise that silence was the canvas. Filling it all in and speeding about all over the place was certainly not my game, and it wasn't what I enjoyed listening to. With five strings, you can be sparse. That's your frame. It's what you work on. Start me up. Can't you hear me knocking? Honky tonk women. All leave those gaps between the chords. That's what I think Heartbreak Hotel did to me. It was the first time I'd heard something so stark. I wasn't thinking like that in those days, but that's what hit me. It was the incredible depth. Instead of everything being filled in with curlicues, to a kid of my age back then, it was startling. With a five-string, it was just like turning a page. There's another story, and I'm still exploring. My man, Waddy Wachtel, guitar player extraordinaire, interpreter of my musical gropings, ace up the sleeve of the expensive winos, has something to say on this topic. Take the floor, Wads. Keith and I come to the guitar with a very similar approach. It's funny. I sat with Don Everly one night. Don was a real drinker at that point. And I said, Don, I gotta ask you something. I've known every song you guys have ever done. That's why I got the job in their band. I know every vocal part. I know every guitar part. Except, I said, there's something I've never understood on your first single, Bye Bye Love. And that's the intro. What the fuck is that sound, man? Who's playing that guitar that starts that song? And Don Everly goes, oh, that was just this G-tuning that Bo Diddley showed me. I went, excuse me? I'm sorry, what did you say? and he had a guitar, so he's putting it in the open G tuning, and he goes, yeah, it was me. And he plays it, and I go, oh my fucking word, that's it. It's you. It was you. I remember when I discovered this weird tuning, as it seemed to me then, Keith had adopted. In the early 70s, I went to England with Linda Ronstadt, and we walked into Keith's house in London, and there's this Strat sitting on a stand with five strings on it. And I'm like, what happened to that thing? What's wrong with that? And he goes, that's my whole deal. What is? He goes, the five string open G tuning. I went, open G tuning? Wait a minute. Don Everly told me about an open G tuning. You play open G tuning? Because growing up and playing guitar, you're learning Stone songs to play in bars. But you know something's wrong. You're not playing them right. There's something missing. I'd never played any folk music. I didn't have that blues knowledge. So when he said that to me, I said, is that why I can't do it right? Let me see that thing. And it makes so many things so easy. Like, can't you hear me knocking? You can't play that unless it's in the tuning. It sounds absurd. And in the tuning, it's so simple. If you lower the first string, the higher string, one step, then the fifth is always ringing through everything. And that's creating that jangle, the inimitable sound, at least the way Keith plays it. Those two strings he travels up and down on, you can do a lot with them. We got on stage with the Winos one night, and we're about to do Before They Make Me Rum. And he goes to do the intro, and he starts to hit it and goes, I don't know which one it is. Because he has so many introductions that are all based on the same form. The B string and the G string. Or the B string and the D string. He just went, which one are we doing, man? I'm lost in a sea of intros. He's got so many of them. A whirling dervish of riffs. Open G intros. When I fell in with Graham Parsons in the summer of 1968, I struck a seam of music that I'm still developing, which widened the range of everything I was playing and writing. It also began an instant friendship that already seemed ancient the first time we sat down and talked. It was like a reunion with a long-lost brother for me, I suppose, never having had one. Graham was very, very special, and I still miss him. Early that year, he joined the Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man and all that. But they just recorded their classic, Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And it was Graham who had totally turned them around from a pop band into a country music band and expanded their whole being. That record, which bemused everybody at the time, turned out to be the incubator of country rock, a major influence. They were touring on their way to South Africa, and I went to see them at Blazers Club. I expected to hear Mr. Tambourine Man, but this was so different, and I went back to see them and met Graham. Got anything? Was probably the first question he asked me, or the more discreet, Anywhere, sure, come back to, I think we went back to Robert Fraser's to hang out, do some stuff. I was taking heroin by this time. He wasn't unfamiliar with it. Doogie was his word for it. It was a musical friendship, but also there was a similar love of a similar substance. Graham certainly liked to get out of it, which made two of us at the time. He also, like me, liked to go for the highest quality. He had better coat than the mafia, did Graham. Southern boy, very warm, very steady under the drugs, calm. He had a troubled background, a lot of Spanish moss and Garden of Good and Evil. At Fraser's that night, we started to talk about South Africa. And Graham asked me, What's this drift I'm getting since I got to England? When I say I'm going to South Africa, I get this cold stare. He was not aware of apartheid or anything. He'd never been out of the United States. So when I explained it to him about apartheid and sanctions and nobody goes there, they're not being kind to the brothers, he said, "Ah, just like Mississippi." And immediately, well, fuck that. He quit that night. He was supposed to leave the next day for South Africa. So I said, "You can stay here." And we lived with Graham for months and months, certainly the rest of that summer of 1968, mostly at Redlands. Within a day or two, I thought I'd known him all my life. It was an immediate recognition. What we could have done if we'd known each other earlier. We just sat around one night, and 5 nights later, we're still sitting up talking and catching up on old times, which was 5 nights ago. And we played music without stopping. Sat around the piano or with guitars and just went through the country songbook. Plus, and a few ideas on top. Graham taught me country music, how it worked, the difference between the Bakersfield style and the Nashville style. He played it all on piano. Merle Haggard, Sing Me Back Home, George Jones, Hank Williams. I learnt the piano from Graham and started writing songs on it. Some of the seeds he planted in the country music area are still with me, which is why I can record a duet with George Jones with no compunction at all. I know I've had a good teacher in that area. Graham was my mate, and I wish he'd remain my mate for a lot longer. It's not often you can lie around on a bed with a guy having cold turkey in tandem and still get along. But that is a later story. Of the musicians I know personally, although Otis Redding, who I didn't know, fits this too, the two who had an attitude towards music that was the same as mine were Graham Parsons and John Lennon. And that was, whatever bag the business wants to put you in is immaterial. It's just a selling point, a tool that makes it easier. You're going to get chowed into this pocket or that pocket because it makes it easier for them to make charts up and figure out who's selling. But Graham and John were really pure musicians. All they liked was music, and then they got thrown into the game. And when that happens, you either start to go for it or you fight it. Some people don't even realize how the game works. And Graham was a bold man. This guy never had a hit record. Some good sellers, but nothing to point to. Yet his influence is stronger now than ever. Basically, you wouldn't have had Waylon Jennings. You wouldn't have had all of that outlaw movement without Graham Parsons. He showed them a new approach. That country music isn't just this narrow thing that appeals to rednecks. He did it single-handed. He wasn't a crusader or anything like that. He loved country music, but he really didn't like the country music business and didn't think it should be angled just at Nashville. The music's bigger than that. It should touch everybody. Graham wrote great songs. A Song for You, Hickory Wind, $1,000 Wedding, great ideas. He could write you a song that came right round the corner and straight in the front, up the back with a little curve on it. I've been writing about a guy that builds cars, and then you listen to it, and it's a story. The New Soft Shoe, written about Mr. Cord, innovative creator of the beautiful Cord automobile, built on his own dime, and deliberately crushed out by the triumvirate of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. Graham was a storyteller, But he also had this unique thing that I've never seen any other guy do. He could make bitches cry. Even hardened waitresses in the Palomino bar who'd heard